This week on the Airplane Geeks podcast, we talk with Rick Beach, the safety chair of the Cirrus Owners and Pilots Association, and also Andre Borschberg, pilot of the Solar Impulse 2. We also bring you an AirVenture Oshkosh 2015 debrief. All that and more coming up now in episode 361. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 361 of the show where we talk aviation. We aim to educate and inform you, explore and develop your passion for aviation, and maybe even entertain you a little along the way. I'm Max Flight, and we'll start out introducing the co-hosts. First, we have Rob Mark. He's a pilot, a flight instructor, an aviation journalist, publisher of the Jetwine blog, and I just learned a CSIP. Hi, Rob.
That's right. Completely different from a seaplane pilot. For those of you that don't know the difference, but we'll talk about that later. Good evening to everyone. And it's nice to be back from beautiful Oshkosh.
Yeah. In fact, we're going to talk about Oshkosh with Rob coming up. But let me introduce our other co-host, Max Trescott, the other Max, Max West. He's a certified flight instructor, also an author, glass cockpit expert, and also a CSIP. Hey, Max.
The other CSIP. Hi, how are you doing? And as opposed to Rob, who was busy at Oshkosh, I was busy talking to all my friends as they were at Oshkosh. So was living vicariously through it. Didn't make it out this year, but hopefully next year.
Absolutely, yeah. So maybe you can be, clarification purposes, CSIP Max, and I can be like not CSIP Max or something like that.
There you go. That's it.
All right. Well, the reason we're talking about CSIP is our guest is Rick Beach. He's the aviation safety chair of the Cirrus Owners and Pilots Association. Rick started his career in high tech and computer science research at the University of Waterloo in Canada in Xerox Park in Silicon Valley. He had a lifelong interest in aviation, but he didn't start pilot training until 2001 when he bought a Cirrus SR-22 based on its safety and technology features and also as a result of the strong pilots and owners community that he saw. Now, Rick has over 3,500 hours in the Cirrus. Cirrus, of course, has an airframe parachute recovery system, and Rick began studying Cirrus accidents to uncover reasons why pilots did not use the system. He even coined the phrase, pull early, pull often, to encourage pilots to use the system before the situation turned dire. Well, Rick chaired the Cirrus Pilot Proficiency Program. He encouraged Cirrus aircraft to focus on telling the story of successful parachute saves, and he participated in three NTSB investigations. He contributed operational knowledge of Cirrus pilot procedures and especially training. Now Rick is working on a concept for the Cirrus Owners and Pilots Association University to expand their safety activities, funded in part by a charitable association, Safety and Education Foundation. So with that, Rick, welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast.
Pleasure to be here, and hope we'll have an entertaining and interesting evening.
One quick question before we move on. How many members are in the Cirrus Owners and Pilots Association? How big is that group?
It's approaching 4,000, wow. Pretty close to that these days, which is pretty remarkable given that there are 6,000 airplanes produced.
Yeah, that really is kind of phenomenal. So fascinating. We'll be talking about Cirrus and safety and the things that Rick is doing coming up. We also have another guest. This is a pre-recorded guest. Max Trescott and I had an interview a few days ago with Andre Borschberg, who's one of the two Solar Impulse 2 pilots. Very exciting conversation we had with Andre. So we have that coming up. And then we've also got some news from the just completed AirVenture Oshkosh 2015. Rob's going to help us understand some of the interesting, important, fun things that happened at Oshkosh this year. With that, is everyone ready?
Ready from the West.
Yep.
The last couple of podcast episodes, we've been talking about the Solar Impulse 2 and its attempts to become the first solar-powered aircraft to fly all the way around the world. There were two folks who are key to that, Andre Borschberg and Bertrand Piccard, and they've put together the financing to make this trip possible. Now, the issue is the Solar Impulse 2 aircraft has only one seat, so it has to be flown solo, so those two gentlemen are alternating legs as they fly this solar-powered aircraft around the world. Now, Andre Borschberg, who we talked with, just flew the most recent leg from Japan to Hawaii over a period of 5 days, which set a new record for solo flight. So that's pretty remarkable to figure out. How do you stay awake for 5 days and five nights? How do you manage a solar aircraft, which relies on power in the daytime and it's on batteries in the nighttime? But just to give you a feel for it, this aircraft is almost as wide as an Airbus 380. It's got a wingspan of 236 feet. But unlike the A380 that weighs 500 tons, it weighs just 5,100 pounds, or a little more than a luxury automobile. It's got 17,000 solar cells on the top of the airplane, which gives it 2,900 square feet of solar area, which is about the average for floor space in a house. So imagine every floor in your house covered with solar cells. And together, the solar cells can generate 66 kilowatts of power, which is enough to simultaneously power about 50 average homes here in the United States. They've got four 17-horsepower electric motors, and they're swinging 13-foot-long propellers. Just imagine the size of those propellers. Now, the whole thing flies at just about 77 knots at top speed in the daytime, but at night they cycle back to 33 knots to save power when they're running off just battery power. And speaking of the batteries, they've got 1,400 pounds of lithium-ion batteries on board. Now, the profile they fly is really kind of bizarre. During the daytime, when they have maximum power available, they charge the batteries and they climb up to 29,000 feet. Then at night, when, of course, the sun is gone, they let the aircraft slowly drift down to 6,000 feet to minimize the drain on the batteries. And while they're doing that, the batteries discharge down to about 15 or 20% of their total capacity before the sun comes up and they do it all over again. So anyway, we talked with Andre, and it was quite interesting to find out what it's like to fly a solar-powered airplane. So here's that interview.
We're talking this morning with Solar Impulse 2 pilot Andre Borschberg. Borschberg, tell us just why you were doing the Solar Impulse project. What are you trying to promote by flying around the world in a solar airplane?
Before we go into the why, let's understand the challenge, because then you will understand better also the goal of what we are doing. If you want to fly with the sun, it's the only source of energy. And if you want to fly day and night, many days, many nights, because that's what we need to do to fly over the ocean, you need an airplane which is extraordinarily energy efficient. Because what you can't change is what the sun gives you in terms of energy. So you cannot increase, in fact, the amount of energy you have. It's given by nature. But what you can do is to increase the way and improve the way you use the energy which is available. So we knew we had to build an aircraft extremely energy efficient. And in fact, the project is more about energy management than about building a new airplane. Let's explain why. In fact, it's so big. It's bigger than a 747 in terms of wingspan. And it explains why it's so light. It's the weight of a big family car. So extremely light in relation to its size. But it's also an airplane which uses very efficient technologies. Just to give you one example, the electric motors that we use to propel the aircraft have an efficiency of 97%. You know, only 3% of loss. If you compare this with the engine that you have in cars, which have an efficiency of 30%, which means that 70% of the gas that you use is lost in heat. That's what makes the difference. So what we want to try to do with this the airplane is not to make people believe that they will fly solar towards their vacation in 5 years. No, that's to really show the potential of these clean technologies, of the potential we have to reduce, in fact, the energy we use, or to use the energy we have available in a much better way. In our world, we always think about how to produce more energy when we need it, instead of how can we better use the energy we have available? That's what we had to do in the airplane. That's what we could do in our world, in the way we build homes, in the way we build cars, in the way we build appliances.
You said that one of the ways you did that is the aircraft had to be very light. Tell us about the materials and the construction techniques you used to make the plane so light.
Well, that was the challenge. If you compare it to a sailplane, which are considered to be very light as well, we are 5 to 10 times lighter, depending on how you compare it and what you compare. So it's a big step forward compared to the way we manufacture sailplane. I mean, we use carbon fibers, but the way we use carbon fibers is different. Can you imagine that the thinnest layer of carbon fibers we use is 25 grams per square meter? Maybe the number doesn't give you an indication of what it means, but 25 grams per square meter is one third of the weight of the sheet of paper that you get from your printer when you print something out of your computer. So it's extremely light, extremely thin. So these are the techniques, these are the technologies that we have developed and used, in fact, to build such a light airplane. And techniques you can use everywhere now for other applications, not just for airplanes.
So the wing is pretty large, and the plane is awfully light. So it sounds like the wing loading is going to be very, very low. What does that really give you an issue when you start to hit turbulence?
It is exactly the question. You're absolutely right to say this. That's reasons why, in fact, we take off normally very early in the morning before sunrise. We land at night after sunset. That's reasons why we fly pretty high. Yeah? We climb to 28,000 feet normally every day. The first goal is to be above the thermals. The second one, it's a way to store energy. So altitude is a reserve of energy for us. So we use flight tactics to make sure that we don't get in the very turbulent situation. And when you fly this airplane, you really feel that you have two types of personalities. When the air is very calm, you know, you can fly with really the fingers of your hands. It's very delicate. It's really nice to fly. But when it's turbulent, you have to use all the flight controls. So you need quite a lot of strength in your muscles to be able to do that. You need a lot of attention, so it's a big work, it's a big workload, so that's the reasons why we try to avoid it.
So I had heard that you had a fairly basic autopilot on the airplane. Is that to suggest that you really could only use it under very, very good conditions when things were smooth, or just tell us when did you use it, and did you have any problems with it?
That was exactly the way we designed the airplane, because it's designed for these specific flights, you know. This would be an airplane which would be used for commercial applications. So, of course, the autopilot would be different. But to use the autopilot in non-turbulent air allows you to build something which is lighter, which uses less energy. Again, you know, having energy efficiency in mind. So the autopilot is used in calm air and is used also for resting period. It worked very well during the flight over the Pacific. What did not work well, and this was a very difficult question when I had to decide of go, no go after takeoff, was the system which supervises the airplane when the pilot is resting. You know, normally in an airplane you have two pilots. When one sleeps, the other one can supervise what the airplane is doing, and when there is a problem, he can react immediately and take over control of the aircraft. But as we are alone, we needed to have a system which does the same in some ways, but cannot take control of the airplane, but can wake and could wake up the pilot. And this system was not working after the initial test flight I did in Japan. And of course, the decision was quite difficult to take. Should we continue or should we return to base?
Well, that's interesting, because we've heard a little bit about the system that wakes you up. Tell us how that works when it's working well. Does Mission Control in Monaco send a signal to make that work? And what kind of technologies would wake you up when it was time?
No, we have different ways, but this is an independent system which measure in a fully autonomous way what the airplane is doing, which kind of inclination, which kind of bank, maybe bank rate, yaw rate, so not only a static position, but also the way it moves, the speed, for example, the angle of attack, so a lot of different parameters. If these parameters are within a range, the system will be fine. And of course, as soon as we get out of the range, it will trigger an alarm, and the alarm will wake up the pilot. If the alarm is using sound, it's also using vibration on the arms or on the body, so that the pilot knows very quickly what he has to do. Because you know, when you wake up, I'm sure you when you travel. And when you have jet lag, for example, sometimes you wake up and you don't know in which city you are. You don't know what time of the day it is. So you are really lost. And it takes time for the brain, in fact, to start functioning well again. And that's what I experienced as well. So to get the information in a different way, directly on the body, of course, is very helpful. And this didn't work. So one solution I had to cope with was to use the control center in Monaco, as you suggested. But Monaco is delayed by 5-6 seconds, so cannot react immediately. It cannot react in real time, which makes it a little bit more difficult.
And a lot of us were watching the flight to Hawaii in real time, and we're watching the graphs of your sleep. And I know that your goal was to sleep in 20-minute segments. How much time on average did you sleep on that particular trip?
The first night I didn't sleep. I rested different times, a different period of 20 minutes, but I didn't sleep. I was too much taken by the decision of going or not going. You know, I had these technical problems when we were aware of this technical problem after departure from Japan. Of course, all the engineers said that the airplane was not in its nominal status and that we should not proceed with the flight. And they were right to say this. But I looked at the mission on a global way, taking account the aircraft status, but also what I could do as a pilot to compensate it and to mitigate, in fact, these deficiencies. I looked at the weather window, which was very good, and it was the first time we had such a good window. And looking at everything, in fact, I really came to the conclusion that the overall risk level was appropriate. But of course, it was very a very emotional environment, also in the control center. And I asked myself, you know, towards my family, do I have the right to do it, to take this this decision? And I really thought about my wife, my kids. So it was hard. So the first night, I really digested that. And I went through all this. And only at sunrise, I could put this on the side and I could start to focus on the mission itself, on the flight itself, on the following 4 days, four nights. And that's really when I got into the process. And then the following nights, I could start, in fact, sleeping part of the time of this 20 minutes break that I could allocate myself.
Yeah, I think we've all had that experience of not being able to get to sleep at night, and those are some really big issues. I'm sure that you were thinking about that first night.
Yeah, that's right. Yes, but I was confident. I think it was really emotions I had. You know, you build this emotion in your body. You feel they are locked in your stomach somewhere, so I had to get rid of it. And meditation helped, yoga helped, and to see a new sunrise also helped to simply turn the page and say, okay, that's done, that's fine. I think I will know how to handle it now. Let's focus, let's continue, and let's enjoy, because you know I really saw this flight as a privilege. And really the possibility to discover not only about technology, but about myself as well.
Yeah. Now, we posted a note on our Facebook page last night that we were going to be talking with you. And somebody said, are you ever truly comfortable going to sleep in a single pilot airplane?
It takes time. In fact, at the beginning, of course, it's completely against what I learned. As a pilot, you are learned not to sleep. It's forbidden, in fact, huh? So it was interesting to go through this experience, because what we can do in this cockpit is to put the backrest horizontally. So the first things you do is that you leave the control of the airplane and you move a little bit backwards. It's not much, huh, but a little bit. Let's say, for example, simply half a meter. The second was to lay down so to lose also the contact with the instruments. And the third one was to close the eyes. And when you close the eyes, and when I closed the eyes, what was interesting is that two things happened. The first one was that I started to listen to all the noises and the sounds that this airplane was making. And these are sounds that I was not aware of before. But when you close the eyes, of course, all these senses start to really be much more active. The second was to feel also what the aircraft was doing. Each small turbulence, each short, small movements, I could feel it. And I could say, the aircraft will do this. If it does that, okay, it's fine. That's the way I expect it to be and so on. So at the beginning, you close the eyes, but as you have all these senses which becomes alive, you wake up because it's very stimulating. So it takes time again, in fact, to build up confidence and really had to tell me the aircraft is fine, he will be able to handle it, trust it. I mean, you know, he's doing great, he's doing a good job, and together you'll be able to make it, but trust it and trust the airplane. So that's what I did after a while, and then it worked. It worked better and better, and then I really could get my rest.
Well, you have to have a really good airplane to trust it. It sounds like you do.
But it's a partner, you know. I see it. Together we get to the destination. We got to the destination, and you build up a relationship. It's not just a piece of carbon fibers with electric motors on it. It's really. It's a little bit of somebody, and after a while, at 5 days, five nights, it's becoming your home. So the cockpit is not just a cockpit; it's the place where you live, which protects you. So I felt good about it. I felt great. I felt home. I felt emotionally related.
That's probably why pilots often give names to their airplanes. Have you given a name to this airplane? A human name?
No, that's a good question. No names, but the feeling that it's more than just materials put together. Mm. You know, it's an entity, and you listen to it, you feel it, and you take care of it. And my role was to bring enough energy to the airplane so it can fly through the night, and his role was to help me to get my energy through resting. So that I could also continue the flight. So, you know, together we helped each other. That's the way I felt it. That's the way I experienced it.
Yeah, a complete system. Now, we had heard that the batteries were damaged when you took off from Japan. Apparently, this is what I've heard, is that you had to make a very rapid climb and then later a rapid descent. I mean, that sounds like a very unusual departure procedure. What actually happened that caused the damage?
You may have heard that we had to do some repair in Japan after the flight from China to Japan. We had damages on the ground because we were unprepared to land in Japan. It was a difficult exercise, and the airplane was slightly damaged by the weather. So when you repair an airplane, you have to do a test flight or a maintenance flight, and that's what I had to do after departure from Japan. So as you say, it was aggressive climb, full power climb to reach altitude or high altitude as quickly as possible. Then it was a fast descent to check air brakes and all the systems. And of course, this was not planned in the design of the aircraft, and this put quite a lot of stress on the batteries. And when you put when you take current out of the batteries, or you bring strong current in, you increase the temperature of the batteries. That's what happened. But I couldn't land in between because in Japan it was very difficult to organize a separate maintenance flight because of the ATC situations, the heavy traffic, the location of the airport, where we were positioned and so on. So we had to do the maintenance flight followed potentially, if everything was fine, directly by this 5 days, five nights flight. This was more than what the airplane was designed for. Mm. And you end up that the batteries were too well insulated, too well protected against the cold that we endure at high altitude, and we just went over the limits, and we damaged the batteries. But you know, they worked so well during the last 5 years. That's what's really funny is that we never thought that we would need replacements and spare parts for all the batteries because we never had any problems. Mm. So we didn't have enough spare parts to replace all the batteries, and that's reasons why we have to manufacture them. And we will do this now over the winter and stay in Hawaii, which is, I tell you, not the worst place to stay, as you can imagine. I mean, people ask me, are you sure you have a technical problem, or is this just something invented so you can stay there?
Right.
But no, it's true. But I have to say also that the people in Hawaii was extremely great, extremely welcoming, extremely helpful to provide a hangar, to provide assistance. So we are very thankful to their support.
Andre, at the beginning of our conversation, you talked about energy management. And we were curious to know, have you learned anything new about energy management since leaving Abu Dhabi? Or was all the development work done in that area before you left?
No, we didn't know much because what we knew was, and what we had was simulated values, you know, the simulated performance of the airplane, but not really fully tested, because we could not do a full 24 hours flight with the airplane before leaving Abu Dhabi, because the airplane was tested doing flight tests in Switzerland last summer. But when you do flight tests, really focus on handling characteristics and everything you have to test. And then it was winter time in Switzerland, no way to do a 24 hours flight because of energy. So this was lacking. So we had to build this experience over time, which we did. And in fact, we learned quite a lot during the first flight from China to Japan, which I did, and flight which I interrupted after 44 hours, but which gave us quite a lot of clues about the performance of the airplane, the way we manage energy, as you say, the possibilities to save energy, because everything is about energy saving in this project. Everything is about energy efficiency. So yes, we gathered a lot of information and could adapt our flight tactics and flight strategy in relation to these findings.
You have a website, futureisclean.org. Tell us about that, and what would you like people to do when they visit that website?
Well, first, it's for them to understand that pioneering work we do is not to make people believe that they will fly solar in 5 years from now. It will take much more time. You know, we are at the time of, if you compare to traditional aviations, we are at the time between the Wright brothers and Charles Lindbergh, who could cross the Atlantic. So that's where we are today. So it will take a long time for transport airplanes to be clean. They will use other technologies which will have to be developed. But the technologies we use of this aircraft, and it's interesting to know that this airplane was not built by the aviation industry. They don't have these technologies available. Was built using technologies which is available by a lot of different companies, industries around the world. Chemical industry, electronics, transportation. So companies who care about energy efficiency. So all the technology we use, in fact, are coming from all the fields which are fields developed for ground applications. So the potential of using these technologies to better use the energy we have on the ground is tremendous. And that's what we want to communicate with this project. If we would use this clean tech extensively around the world, we could reduce our energy consumption worldwide by 50%. So instead of always thinking about how to produce more energy, we could and we should think about how to better use the energy we have available. And that's what we want to promote. So that's what we want to promote with Future is Clean. So people can go, join us, support us. They can also present, of course, their ideas. But our goal is to come and go to COP21, which is the conference of the head of state, which will be held in Paris by the end of this year, which will, of course, talk about the climate, but normally with a strong focus about the problems and not enough about the solutions. And what we really would like to do is to be able to go to COP21 with the support of a lot of people worldwide who are concerned about this question of energy, resources, CO2, climate, and to make heads of government understand the potential of these clean technologies and what we can do about that. So we believe, you know, this is not an ecological questions. It's an opportunity to develop new product, new industries, new jobs about these clean technologies. So that's what we want to communicate to the head of state.
We'll go ahead and put links to those websites on our site so that people can find that in our show notes for the podcast. So, André Borsberg, thank you very, very much for spending time with us here today. Could we ask you to join us again, perhaps after you complete another leg of the trip next year?
Yeah, with great pleasure. It was great to have these few minutes together, but I hope and people can follow us also live on the website solarimpulse.com or .tv. We broadcast live when we fly. We share experience from the cockpit. So these are also very interesting moments.
Oh, I'm so happy you brought that up. I watched it for hours, and it was just fascinating. Your website was phenomenal, showing all the data coming back from the cockpit. We could monitor your airspeed, your direction. We could see what the battery energy level was. It was just an amazing website, and it was really great fun watching you in the cockpit there.
Happy to hear that. Happy to hear that. So looking forward to get more people on board. And please, for the people who will listen to this podcast, visit Future is Clean and also participate. We need your voice. Huh? We need your participation.
Very good. Thank you, André.
Thank you to you. All the best.
Yep. Thank you very much.
All right. Fascinating conversation. André's an interesting guy, and we certainly got sort of the inside view of what had been happening in the recent flight of the Solar Impulse 2.
Nice job. Oof.
Yeah, the way he talked about that airplane, it almost sounded like a living being, and you know, yes, being together when we had each other, and it's like, wow, it was almost the romance of, you know, some of the writing you hear from some of the old aviation writers.
Yes, yes. So we're very grateful to the Solar Impulse team and to André Borsberg for having the time available to speak with us. As Max Trescott knows, the scheduling was pretty tight. They're pretty managed in terms of their ability to speak with other people.
Yeah, it worked out really well in that we got the approval for the interview while I think I was the only one on the team who was still awake. And
that's
then
right.
We did it early the next morning.
Yeah, time zones worked in our favor this time.
They did.
They did. They did. So again, the website's the Solar Impulse 2 project is solarimpulse.com. The website that André spoke of is futureisclean.org. And we'll also put a link to the UN Climate Conference, the COP21 conference that he mentioned in the show notes. So you can find them all there. All right. Well, with that AirVenture Oshkosh 2015, Rob was, the only one of us who attended this year. Rob, you've been to quite a few Oshes over the years, haven't you?
Quite a few Oshes, yes. I think you could say I'm Osh rich. actually, it was really fun this year. I mean, it was an anniversary for me. It's probably the 50th year that I have attended one of these events, and for those of you that do the math, you say, well, they haven't been in Oshkosh that long. I know, because I started going when they were still in the smaller Rockford Airport area just west of Chicago, back when I was a mere child. But it was great as usual, I think. Weather was astounding. I think it's the first year that I can remember that we didn't have some violent thunderstorms. We had great lunches. I had posted something on JetWine a week or two before the show and said, hey, anybody that wants to hang out together, come on, we'll all meet for lunch a couple of different days. And we did. I think we must have had 20 or 22 different people from all over the country just sitting down with Scott and I. We're just schmoozing and lunching and having a good time, and it was really great. But let me ask you: do you want me to give you my version of all the stuff, or do you want me to wait till later? I mean,
no need to wait, Rob. Let's hear the stuff.
Just hear the stuff. Well, what I think what made this different for me this year, other than the the graybeard anniversary was that this is the first year in a long time that I've been at AirVenture when I wasn't working for someone, needing to be in one particular place all week long for a client. So I took it upon myself to try out some volunteer efforts this year. And I worked every day at EAA Radio. I co-hosted the Attitude Adjustment show with Amy Labota, who a lot of folks may know from Women in Aviation. And we had an awful lot of fun interviewing guests and hearing about all kinds of great stuff that was going on at the show. And I also spent my afternoons at the EAA Pilot Proficiency Center, which was a room with 12 simulators in it, 6 VFR, 6 IFR. I volunteered as an instructor, and we ran through an awful lot of scenario training with people that walked in that wanted to kind of get current on some interesting stories that led to interesting outcomes while they flew in a nice, safe manner, of course. And I think on Thursday alone, we ran almost 700 people through the Proficiency Center from 8 in the morning. I think it ran till almost 6 o'clock at night. So we had an awful lot of people that were able to take advantage of it. And, of course, it was Redbird Simulators. It was sponsored by EAA and Flying Magazine and a number of other organizations. So it was really well attended. But then in terms of the stuff, well, it depends on what you like, because there were production airplanes, light sports, ultralights, home builds, helicopters, warbirds. There were helicopter rides in Bell 47s that people may remember from the MASH TV series. Those helicopters barely stopped flying at dark. I think they must have just been exhausted each day, because they flew from early in the morning until late at night. Pioneer Airport, which is a recreation of an early grass strip, had all kinds of things going on for kids. Wednesday was Women Venture Day, which I forgot what the color. Each year, the ladies that attend Women Venture wear a different color shirt. And this year, I think it was some kind of blue. And then they had their picture taken over at the Boeing flight line. And I forgot how many hundreds of them showed up. There was an incredibly boring administrator talk, but but who's mentioning the administrator? I can't imagine that. What else did I say? Oh, the A350 was there.
Yeah, how was that? How did that look?
It was amazing. I watched it on takeoff, and I'll grant you, I know he must have been light when he took off, so they probably weren't. They were probably taking off at a reduced power setting, but that airplane was so quiet. It was unbelievable. Even when he did his high-speed pass, I mean, it was just unbelievable. So I don't know. Max, what kind of motors are in that thing?
Rolls-Royce, but there's a lot of things going on these days to reduce the noise footprint of jet engines. And so, yeah, they're getting to be very quiet.
But then the quiet didn't last long.
The military planes, right?
Because the F-22s came out. And then the F-35 came out.
Now, did the F-35 fly was there a demonstration flight?
Yes, it did fly. It did some low passes and a few sporty maneuvers. The old come across the field at 900 knots and suck the stick back and disappear into the clouds.
Yeah.
You know how they do that sort of thing.
Yeah, and those thrust vectoring nozzles that both the F-35 and the F-22 have, although they're different types, those produce really amazing sort of, well, almost acrobatics in the air.
Well, that's true. I didn't see all the acrobatics, though, because I was busy on the phone calling in a noise complaint to the tower at Oshkosh, because it was, no, I'm just kidding.
Yeah, no, they are loud, though.
I think one of the stars of the show was Icon's aircraft, I should know the name of it right off the top of my head. It's the Icon.
That's the A5.
A5.
Built right here in the Silicon Valley part of the world, which is kind of
yes. The Icon A5. Oh my gosh, were there ever an awful lot of people around the Icon A5? And they delivered the first aircraft, which was a bit of a surprise to the Young Eagles program at EAA. So we don't know how many they actually have orders for, but I have to tell you, it is a cool looking little airplane. However, equipped, it's $230,000, and it's a light sport aircraft. It's a little tough. Then of course David would have been drooling. There was a drone cage where they had these little doohickey flapper thingies buzzing and zinging around in the box to do little things that drones do.
Did you get to fly?
They were doing it.
Yeah.
Yes, and it was very. It was actually pretty cool to watch what they were doing with them.
Was there a lot of interest in those, Rob?
There were quite a few people around the cage on the outside, and then they also had seating inside the tent where folks that wanted to be inside, out of the sun, could watch the demonstration and hear a moderator kind of explain what was going on, and so that was also pretty cool. In the evening, of course, there are always parties of one sort or another, the formal ones, the informal ones, because there are thousands of people camping all over the darned airport. And it was really fun. I ran into a guy that I used to work with back in, oh my gosh, I hadn't seen him since about 1979 or 1980.
Hmm.
And he and I were both controllers together in Chicago. And he found me through Jetwine. And it was really fun to go hang out and realize how old he'd gotten.
Yeah, I was going to say, did he immediately recognize you when he saw you?
He recognized me. I did not recognize him. He was a little younger then.
Well, you were too.
I guess that.
But maybe you looked the same as when you did back then.
I guess that's true. But no, it was fun. So we went back to a campsite. He was parked over at the light sport area near the little light sport grass strip, and we sat around and had a few. Mai Tais or something. I don't know what they were, but he makes some mean drinks. But he's a dispatcher at American. But anyway, and I think the last thing that was Safe Dinner, Max Truscott, you probably know. I think you're a Safe member too, aren't you?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so there were about 100 and I think John Dorsey said there were about 140 people at the Society of Flight Educators dinner on Thursday night, and it's many flight instructors, but it's also teachers from all over the aviation industry, so that was a really good time. And then by the end of that dinner, all I could think of was, I only have to do one more show, one more lunch, and I can go home the next day. So it was just great. But I tell you, the thing that makes Oshkosh so fun is that there's something for everyone, no matter what your aviation interest. And it's just a matter of finding it and then hanging out there all week.
Rick, had you been to Oshkosh before?
Yes, I've attended a couple of them and spent time talking to various safety groups, obviously some of the serious people, but also campaigning for better investigations. It's been a fun experience.
I imagine that you might have the same kind of feeling about Oshkosh that I hear from most people, which is that it's about the people. It's less about the airplanes and so forth, more about the relationships and the friendships that you form, things like that. Does that sort of fall in line with how you think about Oshkosh?
Right. Since I have a plane and I wasn't in the market for another one, It was an opportunity to meet people, to talk about various aviation topics with lots of interested people.
Hmm, fantastic. Now, Rob, there was something going on with NASA and collision avoidance at Oshkosh, wasn't there?
Oh, there certainly was. In fact, NASA was still conducting some research for a new piece of technology that they put together to try to reduce the controlled flight into terrain problem with general aviation airplanes. I mean, and while you know, CFIT isn't the biggest killer these days, loss of control is still right up there at the top. The NASA's figures say that more than 100 people die every year from essentially flying perfectly good airplanes into the ground. The question is, why and what can be done to fix the problem? Hmm. And it was a problem, I found out, with the Air Force as well, and in that it was because of this interest on the part of the Air Force to stem the tide of these CFIT accidents that this technology was developed for the digital versions of the F-16. Because, of course, most listeners probably know that a fighter pilot, if things get really bad, a fighter pilot just punches out. But what happens after that is a $70 million airplane goes into the drink or into the side of a hill or into the ground. And that's actually a large chunk of cash to lose, considering that they were losing somewhere between one and two F-16s every year. So they partnered up with the guys at NASA's Armstrong Flight Research Center over at Edwards, and the guys got together and came up with something that was pretty cool. And I guess the best way to explain it is to sort of think of it as an app for the F-16's electronics, and it did a pretty nice job of slowing the CFIT rate. And then the NASA guys said, this is pretty cool. I wonder if there's someplace else we could use this technology.
Hmm.
And what they did was settle on some drone technology initially, some drone aircraft, I should say. And then also they decided to see if it might work in the general aviation community. And lo and behold, the result was the research they were conducting at AirVenture. I was one of about three dozen pilots who had a chance to try out this new app. And believe it or not, it was a beta version working on an iPhone that was just sitting on a little stand right in front of me on the simulator. And it was pretty darn cool. They called it the iGround Collision Avoidance System, iGAX or something, I guess would be the way to put it. But, of course, if it comes to be in a commercial version, it'll probably be installed on an iPad, or also they're looking into seriously getting it into the primary flight display or the multifunction display on a glass airplane. And so that depends on how the research goes, but they're just about done with that. What it does is it's magic. I guess that's the best way to explain the innards, since I'm not an engineer. But it essentially looks at the altitude an aircraft is flying at, and if it is lower than the terrain around it, it will give the pilot a visual warning. Approaching terrain and offer a green arrow to the left or to the right and say, hey, here's how you can get away from all that nasty, hard granite stuff if you'll just listen to me. But, of course, they also know there are going to be those pilots who say, nah, I don't need to listen to that. I'm a real pilot. And if they wait too long, the system will become a little more dramatic. And the display turns red, and it yells at you, full power, climb left, or full power, climb right. And it is the pilot's job at that point to obviously add full power, pitch up, and to get that baby climbing at the best rate of climb speed to get away from the rocks. It will keep yelling at you until you are clear of the terrain. I thought that was pretty cool. And considering the fact, I think I flew about 6 or 7 different scenarios that they had programmed into this simulator. And every time we flew it, we had to have a thorough debriefing after which the researchers would ask, what did you like? What did you not like? What worked? What did you have any suggestions on better ways to present the information and that sort of thing? Again, it was really pretty interesting, and I think what was probably the most interesting is that when those scenarios came to be, they put me under the hood so I couldn't really see out the windows. And once I got used to it, and it didn't take me very long, but I don't know, maybe that's because I'm used to flying airplanes that have traditional ground proximity warning systems in them, that when that warning goes off and it says full power climb left, don't even think about it. You just push those throttles forward and you pitch up. And even the app has a safeguard in it to make sure that it optimizes the climb angle so that some poorly trained pilot doesn't just shove the throttle in and yank the stick back and pitch up until the airplane stalls. So they really had quite a bit figured out. And they think that the research on this IGCAS should be done by early fall. They'll have a detailed report about the system out by October or so. And NASA's hoping that some private company's going to jump in and grab the technology and try and commercialize it and hopefully reduce the CFID accident rate. So I wish them a lot of luck because I just thought it was a marvelous little piece of technology.
Yeah, you answered my question. I was going to ask you how close this is to being a commercial product, and it sounds like it's not too far away.
No, not well. The research is just about done. But Mark Skoug, who is NASA's project manager on the IGCAS, is there a good way to say that? ICAGS, you guys figure it out. I don't know. But again, he told me that they're not just waiting until all the research is done. They've been talking to the Honeywells and the Rockwell Collins and Avidyne and some of the other ones to kind of prepare them for what is coming down the pike. And so everybody knows what it will do right now, and they're still tweaking it, but they think, again, that when this research is let go of in early fall, that a couple of companies are going to want to scoop it up and get it inside airplanes like the Cirrus, which already has a glass cockpit.
All right. Well, there was some noise, I'll call it. There were some articles, some things in the press about third-class medical reform that came out during Oshkosh. Max Trescott, yeah, were you following this?
Yeah, the series of events was that midway during the week, the FAA Administrator Michael Huerta spoke and said that reform of the pilot medicals was coming no time soon. I'm not sure that's the exact quote, but basically it was kind of don't hold your breath. In parallel, AOPA and EAA and others have been working with Congress to go ahead and see if they could just pass it as legislation because they know that things will be slow if they wait for a rule to come from the FAA itself. And so earlier in the year, the Pilots Bill of Rights 2 was introduced. And that's going to basically, if it passes, allow pilots to no longer need a third-class medical in a fairly broad range of circumstances. And so the research on this is based on the light sport aircraft and the no medicals required for flying LSAs if you have a sport pilot license. And so what they found is that it really hasn't been an issue. That is, we're not having a lot of incapacitated pilots flying without medicals who are having crashes. So they want to extend this to a wide range of recreational flying. Essentially, it would allow a private pilot to fly VFR and IFR flights in an aircraft up to 6,000 pounds with up to six seats. A pilot could carry, five passengers up to altitudes of 14,000 feet, and they'd be limited to 250 knots, which covers a pretty wide range of aircraft that are flying GA today. And then toward the end of the week, we heard that that particular language from the Pilot's Bill of Rights bill had been also attached to the Highway Bill as an amendment. Now, of course, there's no relationship between the two, but I think the co-sponsors felt that was a great way to try and help force this through because they figured the Highway Bill would probably get passed. And the latest word out today is that there's a whole lot of contention around the Highway Bill, so that's being held up for a variety of reasons. And, of course, there are different versions of the Highway Bill, the House's version, the Senate's version. This Pilot Bill of Rights is only attached to the Senate version. So if they end up going with the House version, then that language might not be there at all. So really, we've got a very narrow window of time to try and pass not the Highway Bill, but the Pilot's Bill of Rights, too. And so EAA and others have come out and essentially said, contact your U.S. senators, your congresspeople, ask them to become co-sponsors for this Pilot's Bill of Rights, too. Right now, there are 55 co-sponsors in the Senate, and if they can get just five more, 60 total, then the bill has to come to a vote. But all this has to happen basically this week, so it's got to happen by the 31st of July. Otherwise, it's not gonna pass in this time frame. And I guess the other thing that really added some urgency to the whole situation was a couple of days ago, ALPA, the Airline Pilots Union, came out against the bill, which was kind of surprising because there's been relatively little opposition to this. And so they kind of put a monkey wrrench in the whole thing, which really increases the urgency for pilots everywhere to stop what they're doing right now, take a couple of minutes, contact their senators and their congresspeople to get behind this bill. And I guess we'll put a link into the show notes where people can figure out a way to automatically contact their representatives. But Rob, I'm curious, do you have any insight as to why ALPA would be so adverse to this?
Well, what I heard was that they do not like the concept of anyone that has not been medically qualified flying in airspace near busy airports or any kind of airports, actually. And I think some of this is fallout from the German Wings crash. There's still an awful lot of controversy floating around about that. But then also, the Airline Pilots Association has taken a pretty tough stand against drones as well for pretty much the same kind of safety reasons. And so while the news release from ALPA came out, I believe, Thursday, the folks at AOPA and EAA were really upset because they've not had any conversations with ALPA about this at all. They were really caught kind of unaware. And I think that was part of the outrage they were sensing. But Max West Rick, I don't know anybody really, at the risk of getting my head handed to me for questioning the third class medical reform, what exactly do you guys think is the motivation? Just to save some pilots the cost of getting a medical exam every couple of years, or was there something else behind it?
Well, I've been subject to a special issuance process for my medical, third class medical, and the paperwork and the data that has to be sent to the FAA is burdensome. And so it takes a long time, in my case, 2 months, for them to process the information that I provided them. So reform of that process to change what the standards are would be very helpful.
And I think it would definitely reduce cost. And you've got a number of folks who are having to decide whether to kind of hang up flying or to start flying light sport aircraft with just two seats. And what this really does is it kind of expands the whole philosophy of the no medical approach to light sport. I think they've got enough data from that now to say this really isn't that big a problem. So let's remove a barrier. Let's lower the cost of flying by doing away with medicals in these particular circumstances. Of course, this has nothing to do with people who are flying commercially. So if you're a charter pilot, a corporate pilot, an airline pilot, yes, everybody is going to still get full scrutiny for those kinds of jobs.
Going to be interesting to see how that all goes down.
Yeah, and how long it takes for it to actually reach a conclusion. Again, we're speaking with Rick Beach, the safety chair of the Cirrus Owners and Pilots Association. Rick, again, welcome to the show. How did you sort of come to be so interested in this aspect of aviation safety or of the Cirrus aircraft in particular?
So the introduction to Cirrus was a magazine article that talked about its advanced use of avionics. My background in computer graphics was complementary to that, and I was fascinated to see how much utility they were getting out of electronics that could use visual displays. So that was very attractive. The safety features, including the parachute, was also attractive. And frankly, a modern aircraft was something that I could fly my family and be happy about it, be confident that I would do a good job. On one of the very first flights that I took across the country, I flew past the location of the first fatal accident in a Cirrus in 2001. And I wondered, what would it be that a pilot with all of that advanced technology in 2001 could end up crashing into the top of a ridge? Turns out to be a VFR and IMC scenario. And I started looking at the accident reports, trying to understand what is it that we're missing. And of course, most of the accidents are pilot caused. So it became quickly understandable that we need to do a different job than has been done in traditional training for pilots and really get into the behaviors that would make better use of the safety features that innovative products like the Cirrus SR20 and 22 series, those innovative features needed to be used. And so I became quite fascinated by why not and how could we make better use of them.
Are these features that you're talking about in the parachute and so forth, are these specific to the Cirrus aircraft or other aircraft have similar kinds of systems?
Oh, lots of aircraft now have similar systems. So the avionics, the primary flight displays, the multifunction displays, the advanced digital autopilots, all of those, maybe they were around, but Cirrus integrated them and made them popular, and lots of other manufacturers have added to it. In the Cirrus case, one of their key innovations was a lot of cockpit ergonomics, putting things in a place where a pilot and a passenger could make easy use of them without it being in the way. And it would be a reduction in injuries, getting the yoke away from your chest, putting the buttons recessed, making sure that the whole experience is something that increases the comfort of someone in the airplane. Lots of other aviation innovators have taken similar approaches to make it more attractive for pilots and their passengers to enjoy flying.
Given that this was the situation, why weren't people looking at this sooner? Was it just a failure to recognize what the data was showing, or was it some other cause?
Well, there definitely was a period of time in which the safety innovations were available, pilots were buying the airplane, and still we were finding pilots crashing. One person put it, new pilots finding old ways to kill new airplanes. Hmm. And when I started looking at it, I realized that the pilots had lots of experience. Half of the fatal accident pilots had more than 800 hours of flying time. Now, granted, they were low time and type, but these are people that had flown for years. And here they were getting into a new airplane and finding bad situations, whether it was VFR and IMC, whether it was instrument procedures. They were getting themselves into old ways. And I started trying to figure out what was holding back better use of these innovative features. And frankly, the way in which flight training was being done in those early days, both in general aviation more broadly, but also within the Cirrus world, it was task-oriented and less decision-making. And you've seen an increase with SAFE and the John and Martha King focusing on risk assessment. And that's a behavioral issue. So within the Cirrus community, especially given that pilots had the option of using the parachute, they had to make different risk assessments. They had to make different decisions about their emergency procedures. So it took a long time to sort of come up with the awareness of what was holding us back and getting into this attitude about it's just another aircraft, because it's not. It's a complex avionics system, which it is, and so therefore you have to train to proficiency. Or we've got an instructor pool that really don't understand what's different between a Cirrus and anything else, and we need them to be better prepared.
Both Rob and Max are flight instructors. When something changes like this, or when the type of instruction needs to change, or the considerations that make up part of the instruction process, how does that flow down to the flight instructors across the world?
Well, that's one of the things that Cirrus did differently than other manufacturers. And that is because they had an innovative aircraft with this advanced avionics and with the parachute, they provided transition training as part of the sales contract. And it was typically about 3 days for someone reasonably proficient. And in my case, I was pretty new to it, and I extended it to 5 days. So Cirrus was in the business of helping pilots be familiar with flying the Cirrus. Now, as the company grew and as recurrent training was needed, they had an ecosystem to build, a set of instructors around the world that could do the same job. And in that process, they needed to put some standards in place to essentially validate that instructors understood what the factory protocols were that they were training, what the standardized procedures were. And that process wasn't quite the easy way to deal with flight instructors. And I'll credit SAFE in 2011 had a symposium, and it was about reforming pilot training. And the way I describe it is they tilted the field towards instructors, professional flight instructors, really thinking differently about how to get pilots to do a better job of flying aircraft like the Cirrus or any technologically advanced aircraft. And that meant they needed knowledge, they needed skills, and they needed the ability to demonstrate proficiency. And so getting that instructor core to sort of work together to really build up and increase the aspiration, the desire for better pilot proficiency really made a big difference.
Max Trescott, does this sort of resonate with you?
Oh, definitely. I was just, as you were making that comment, Rick, I was thinking about the number of times I've heard people come to me for Cirrus instruction, and they'll say things along the line of, you know, I need to find a better instructor. The one I have doesn't know much about the airplane. He's sitting in the right seat and kind of learning about the airplane as he's trying to teach me. And that's just absurd. I mean that's just a formula for disaster. And yet, if you're in a situation where sometimes flight instructors are kind of scrapping for, you know, the next job, the next, income, you know, they'll often just say yes to anybody who comes along, even though they may not really be fully qualified in an airplane. And that's an unfortunate situation. It's part of the reason that I specialize in just certain areas, and other instructors who are lucky enough to have a business, enough business specialize. If you're in certainly a remote area, you may have to take every job that comes along, and that's where we start to encounter problems. But I also think that Cirrus really represented a huge paradigm shift when they brought out a new airplane with a parachute. And I think the issue is that there are a lot of folks who learned before Cirrus came out, and what they learned was, hey, if the engine quits, you look for a nice field and you circle down and you land in it. And of course, your superior pilot skills will keep you safe. And I think what we found through all the data is that's just not the case, that you're actually safer, pulling the parachute unless you happen to have a runway right below you when the engine quits.
Well, as a non-pilot, the airframe parachute always seemed like a really good idea to me. Is that something that Cirrus has patents on or something? I mean, why don't we see that in more airplanes?
So Cirrus does not have patents on it, although Ballistic Recovery Systems, the inventor of the ballistic parachute system that's used in the Cirrus, does. Hmm. But if you're if you're an aviation engineer, think about putting a 60 to 80 pound parachute pack somewhere in an airplane, and you've got gross weight issues, usable load gets decreased. You've got, more importantly, center of gravity issues, because where do you put that? If you put it at the back, now you've got a tail-heavy plane. And furthermore, you've got to find a way in which the rocket extracts the parachute, but it's still attached to the airplane. So Cirrus, in their design, integrated that challenge from the very beginning. And they came up with a solution that puts it in a place where the gross weight can be handled, the CG can be handled, the extraction can be handled, and all of the other stuff makes for a safe outcome. So interestingly, when trying to do this with other models of airplanes, they have those barriers to overcome unless they're doing a clean sheet design and they get to start from the beginning. So we're seeing a very slow introduction. And frankly, the challenge of old designs taking on new concepts, is there a market for that kind of activity that justifies the engineering? So we have a market issue, we have kind of a historical acceptance of it, and then just a simple engineering challenge.
Are there a lot of misconceptions out there about the airframe parachute?
Well, you said something interesting a moment ago as a non-pilot. In my experience, I've flown many people who are non-pilots, and I give them the briefing. Here's the handle. Here's what you do as a passenger. If I'm incapacitated, anyone in the plane can pull it. That briefing goes over very well, and it's very comforting. Add to that the big windows, and generally, non-pilots getting into a Cirrus have a really good experience. Now, when you talk to pilots, especially pilots who can't afford a Cirrus, who don't like plastic airplanes, oh boy. Then all of a sudden, a whole range of misconceptions come out because there are all these things about real pilots don't need parachutes. Max just mentioned it in terms of emergency landings. Every pilot in the United States certified by the FAA has to demonstrate that they can pick a field and approach it in a power-off emergency landing. That's not a good thing if you've got a Cirrus with a parachute. So we've got lots of misconceptions.
You know, something I wanted to mention, too, is that I remember when I went through the simulator up in Duluth while I was getting my CSIP, and I think they took me out at in the simulator out at night and did something to the engine. And, of course, all the way down, I kept trying to get the engine restarted, and I was trying to look for an open spot to land. And the first time I prang the airplane, and they climbed into the sim and said, "Why didn't you pull the chute?" And I said, "Ah, that's interesting. I completely forgot about the chute. I mean, I've got a lot of time and I never flew an airplane with a chute. So it just wasn't in my sequence of keeping myself alive in the airplane." And the other thing I think that that I try to instruct with students now is that you have to realize the handle, Max, it's not in your field of vision while you're flying. It's above you. It's above essentially the top of your head. So if you don't look up there and say, "Oh, yeah, the chute," it may get right past people. And I realize that there are people that say, "Well, that's a pretty lame excuse for not blowing it off," but that's just my particular opinion. It doesn't mean that it's bad. I'm just saying that it takes a while to change the way that people that were trained in conventional airplanes think to say, "Don't, by the way, don't forget the chute." But honestly, too, the Cessna, the 162, I believe, didn't that have a ballistic parachute system, Max?
Ooh, I don't think so.
No? Okay, I thought maybe it did, but I know the Icon does. They were talking about that the other day. So these days, you know, there is a little more talk about that, but it's, you know, we're not all there yet.
So, Max, Rob brings up an interesting point, which is how do you help pilots overcome this human factors issue? It's out of sight, but it's easy, Max, to touch your head and reach for the handle. So if you're disoriented, there's a way to find it pretty easily. What we found in sort of researching with simulator experiences, pilots telling us stories of near, you know, exciting emergencies where they didn't think about the parachute, what we've got is a human factors issue. And our key factors that addressed that were, first, we needed a message. And we needed to get into pilots' heads that this is possible. That's where the pull early, pull often, and for emergencies, consider caps. We wanted to get them on the ground before they even get to the airplane thinking about it. Next, we needed to leverage the training network. And we needed to stop having instructors say, don't touch that handle. We needed people to really understand pilots have a transition to go through. And then we needed to tell the stories. There have been 57 successful, survivable deployments of the parachute with 109 survivors. So we've landed Cirruses under canopy in a whole bunch of different places and a whole bunch of different stories. And people need to know. People have gone before and survived. And then finally, Rob's point, we need to help people practice the habits of using these safety features. And so at the Cirrus Pilot Proficiency Program, we encourage people to come up with a departure briefing that goes, you know, when I enter this runway, this is how I'm going to handle the winds. And when I get to 500 feet, then the parachute's active and I can raise the flaps and be prepared for the use of the parachute quickly. At 2,000 feet above the ground, then I've got options to troubleshoot. Every takeoff departure begins to build that habit. And when you say caps and flaps at 500 feet, reach up and grasp the handle, because then, Rob, it becomes part of your muscle memory. And when you've got an emergency, it's more likely that that memory, that habit, will be available to people.
Absolutely. Well said.
Rick, what's next for you?
What's next is we've had great success in reducing accidents. There's stories out there that we've reduced the accident quite significantly below where general aviation is. And of course, people say, is that a trend? Well, it's a really good historical trend. The challenge, will it be a continuing future trend? So one of the things that the Cirrus Owners and Pilots Association did is formed a charitable foundation to fund COPA University, which is taking the things that we've learned and expanding its reach, covering technologically advanced aircraft with other innovative designs, integrated avionics, special autopilots, and the like, and putting together a set of knowledge courses, a set of laboratories that can work on procedure training, as well as online access to resources that would help train people. So we're in the process of starting that up. We've got to a really good place with our current programs. The results are very heartening. We're looking forward to continuing that, and we're not done yet. We get new pilots flying Cirrus aircraft, buying used airplanes. We've got new instructors, so it's an evergreen problem.
And are there some places online where our listeners could go to learn more about this?
Right now, the best place to go would be the cirruspilots.org website. There are discussion forums there. The COPA University is being designed and produced, and we're not quite ready for prime time to tell how we're going to do it because we're kind of learning as we go. We've got a team of people with great expertise, and we're looking forward to doing that in the future.
So, Rick, I always hear a lot of misinformation about why Cirrus actually included the parachute. Can you give us the kind of the historical reasons for why there is a parachute in the Cirrus?
One of the misconceptions is that Cirrus put the parachute on there because it was the only way to pass spin certification. The reality is the Cirrus parachute is there because one of the founders, Alan Klapmeyer, survived a mid-air collision while he was under the hood doing his instrument training. And on the way down, it's like there's got to be a better way. So the Cirrus was designed with the parachute from the very beginning. Apparently, the spin-resistant wing design was one thing that the FAA was very keen to be included in a certified aircraft. And they convinced Cirrus to include that and to be able to go through an equivalent level of safety using the parachute to deal with spin recovery. Now, it turns out the stall-resistant wing, the one that has the cuff, it's harder to get into a stall, it's harder to get into a spin, but once you're in a spin, it's harder to recover. So the one-and-a-half-turn spin requirement was the way in which the FAA and Cirrus agreed there would be an equivalent level of safety to spin testing. The Europeans, when it came time for Cirrus to get type certified in Europe, the Europeans said, sort of, show us. And so Cirrus had to do a reduced spin matrix of at least 60 spins to show that it was recoverable under conventional techniques. So Cirrus has that European data plus the equivalent level of safety to honor Alan Klapmeyer's original design. There has to be a better way.
Can you imagine, though, what it would have been like to be in that airplane in Europe doing 60 spins? Yeah. By the end of the day or however long it took, your brains would be scrambled.
Hopefully they did that over more than one day.
I hope so. Yeah, I know. I was just kidding, really.
Rob, there's an interesting human drama to that observation. The test pilots have a high fatality. Well, I don't know about high, but they have a fatality rate. And many of the test pilots are well known in the aircraft engineering community across all the manufacturers. And so to put a test pilot in that kind of situation when everybody agrees that the parachute works really brings some angst to the executive that's going to make a decision. Test pilot, you go make those 60 spins. And that's tough.
All right. Well, very interesting. Thanks, Rick. Really appreciate you spending a little bit of time with us.
I appreciate the opportunity. Thanks, guys.
The didgeridoo means it's time for the Australia News Desk. Here's two of the craziest guys we could find south of the equator. It's Steve Vischer and Grant McHaren from the Plane Crazy Down Under podcast.
Dateline, 27th of July, 2015.
Well, g'day, folks, and welcome to the Australia Desk for episode 361 on this rather chilly night here in Melbourne. Grant, in fact, you know what? It's so chilly, I'm sitting here in the studio wearing my Buffalo Airways hoodie.
Wow, that is cold, mate. That is cold.
I'll tell you what, they must get cold up there in Canada because, you know, I'm almost sweating wearing this thing. It's very thick.
Oh, sounds like it. So was that Canada or Scandicanadia?
Yes, Canada. You know, I just say that just to upset Canadians. You know, the quickest way to upset a Canadian is to ask him what part of the U.S. he's from. I actually learnt that several times to my detriment when I was living in the U.S.
Yes.
Sorry about that, Canadians.
As a Canadian pilot mate of mine likes to say, the only thing a Canadian's patriotic about is the fact they're not American.
There we go. How did we get sidetracked with that? Grant, let's talk aviation. Hey, you know what, Grant? We could actually play the whole report this week instead of just the U bit they played last week.
Yeah, well, I guess they just wanted to go straight to the important bit. But, oh, did I say that? No, I thought it was more that Max wanted to trim the Ausdesk down to size for a change.
No, we might talk a little bit about that in a minute, Max, because I just want you to feel a bit more guilty about it, Grant. But let's talk about something that's really going to upset you, a Qantas article. Qantas privatization, the flying kangaroos, deregulation success, trumpets this headline in the Australian Business Review. Wow, you're going to love this, Grant. Privatization of Qantas under the Keating Labor government sparks fears the airline would no longer have cash to invest in new aircraft and would not represent the national interest. But as the 20-year anniversary of privatization looms, Qantas is quick to point out that it's actually doing rather well.
Yeah, it's interesting what happens when you stop stripping all the money out of the mainline to try and prop up Jetstar. Oh, did I say that? I'm sorry.
You're handling it much better than I thought, buddy. I was going to let the nuclear alert go off at one point, but I just couldn't find the right sound effect, unfortunately. But
That's okay. That's okay, mate. You gave me enough time to read the article and have a few
moments. A few palpitations. That's exactly. Back in 1995, in fact, on July 31st, 1995 is when Qantas was privatised. Before that, the government basically ran the whole operation there. And interestingly enough, it was privatised by the anti-privatisation crusaders, the Labor government. So go figure.
Yeah, oh, mate. They were the ones. Honestly, a lot of people say that from Hawke onwards, Labor hasn't been Labor anyhow. It's been Hawke, then Keating, and on we go from there. So, yeah. It's not a surprise. They were after the money. They needed to balance the books. They'll sell anything. And voila, they did. They sold Qantas. But also at the same time, there was more deregulation going on. For a very long time, we had the two airline policy here in Australia, which was that you had to have two major airlines and no one else. And as a result, it was not uncommon to see the aircraft of one airline leading or following the other airline on the identical route at the identical time. It was rather odd. And there's a lot of people who go, oh, but yes, remember the good old days when people used to dress up and they'd treat it with respect and get yobbos. And yeah, that was when it used to cost you $500 Australian one way between Sydney and Melbourne for a domestic economy ticket. And these days you can go to Sydney and back from Melbourne for about, what, $240 return?
Something like that, yeah. Well, it's interesting, Grant, some of the stats here. It says that in 1995, Qantas had a fleet of 136 aircraft and flew to 86 destinations. Today, this article says they're operating 297 aircraft and they operate to 145 domestic and international destinations. And that's not including Jetstar, it says here, which flies to 49 destinations of its own. Well, not of its own, really, Grant. In fact, it flies to a lot of the same places that Qantas mainline flies to.
They make a big thing about the same levels of staff, and instead of only flying 16 million passengers, they're now flying 50. And, well, let's face facts. They're flying bigger aircraft, so each aircraft's carrying more passengers. But, mate, I think it is kind of interesting, the question of those 50 million that Qantas is flying, how many of them are actually flying on Qantas aircraft as opposed to Emirates?
Yeah, that would be something I'd like to know, is how many of those 50, although 50 million is, I mean, it's a big figure, and it would be interesting to know absolutely what percentage of those are actually flying in Qantas aircraft. I'd still say a fair chunk of them, but it would certainly be interesting to know how many are flying on code-shared services, you know, with other carriers.
Yep. How many are on Jet Connect going to and from New Zealand, which has the Qantas Red Tail with the roux on it, but it's flown by a different company with pilots operating out of New Zealand. It's an interesting question. They have increased their number of destinations, but a large part of that is they're now also flying to more places domestically, let alone international. And again, of those international destinations, how many actually see a red tail?
Now, this article is giving a lot of props to Alan Joyce. In fact, it's basically saying that, from the time Alan Joyce took over, that things actually changed for Qantas. Well, we all know they've had a pretty rough ride, but they certainly are a leaner operation. And a lot of that's really because they fired a lot of people. I mean, there's not nearly as many people working for that airline these days as there was back when it was privatised. And, you can make your own judgments, I guess, as to whether that's a good or a bad thing.
Yeah, look, I mean, Qantas have turned a corner. There's no doubting it. Things are getting better. I think that some attitudes from on top have changed, and I think a lot of the cunning plans that may have been going on have been ditched. You know, we all know, as I alluded to before, about propping up Jetstar to make it look better. There was back in the time when they were looking at actually trying to leverage debt just before the global financial crisis, that would have made a big packet of money for some of the senior execs and left Qantas with a huge debt load that, had they done that just before the global financial crisis, it would have killed them. There's been a lot of very interesting and, I would say, just dumb decisions by management that they seem to have finally turned around, and they're starting to run it like a bloody airline now. They're starting to actually do things with it. I mean, we've heard about the Red Q disaster that was supposed to be narrow-bodied aircraft with super premium seats that were better than on an A380 based over in Asia. So it'd be majority owned by an Asian airline or entity, and yet it was going to return a profit, making money to prop up international for Qantas. I mean, it just didn't even compute. And this was being traipsed around and made a big thing of before they had even locked down who was their partner. It was just ridiculous, absolutely brain dead management. And this was going on, and these are now the same people who apparently are the big heroes and everything's going great. So a few things have changed in attitudes up the top, I think. It's great. I'm really, really happy that they're turning the corner and that things are looking up. And I really hope it does continue. There's a lot of wonderful people in Qantas. They deserve much better than what they've had from their management over the last 10 to 20 years. And I'm really hopeful that this is an indication that finally the people at the top have realized they have to run this like a real airline and do it properly.
Well, there you go, Grant. You know what? It's kind of hard to believe it's been 20 years already since they were privatized, but there's no going back now. But Grant, let's talk about briefly one other airline, their competitor, in fact, Virgin Australia. Qantas might be lauding all the benefits of privatisation, but Virgin in June, well, they took the honours for the most punctual domestic carrier in this country.
Woohoo! Who knew? Because they've had a bit of a run of not really being top of the pops when it comes to punctuality. So good on them, and great to see that they've managed to correct whatever was causing the problem and get themselves back into center line? Or is it that the others have all dropped down? Well, no, because apparently Tiger Air was the biggest improver in June, with its on-time departure performance improving 4.9% to 89.5. Woohoo!
I wonder how their complaints department performance is coming along. Granted, it was only, what, how many years has it been now? 6 years?
Yeah,
I'm still waiting.
Not the accounting. Still waiting.
Well, this is a report from the Bureau of Infrastructure, Transport and Regional Economics, or BITRE, whatever.
Yeah, them.
This report shows that 92.1% of Virgin's flights arrived on time in June, while 93.2% of its services pushed back from the departure gate on time, while Qantas, which led the punctuality rankings in May, dropped back to second in June with 90.7% on time and 91.4% on time departure rate. So also lifting its performance in the month, but not enough to take the honours. So I don't know really what that means really for anything at all, but there you go. And that article is, of course, in our favourite aviation publication, Australia. AustralianAviation.com.au. Now, Grant, let's go. We just have to embarrass Max just once or twice more. No, or just once. Now, folks, it was a very short Australia desk last week. That's because there was a bit of a mistake. Well, I'm not sure. Is it Max's fault or is it your fault, Grant? You put your report in the Dropbox where we normally put our report, and Max picked up that one and not the other one. So, folks, if you want to hear the entire Australia desk report from last week's episode, well, you can go over to our archive site, australiadesk.net, and we'll put a link in the show notes just to embarrass Max even more. Think that's enough?
I don't know. Do we want to be invited back to do another Australia Desk next week?
No, I'm sure he'll invite us back. Until then, I'm Steve Fisher.
And I'm Grant, the one who probably is the cause of all the problems, McCarran.
Ah, oh, McCarran. You've done it again.
Oh, you've been waiting to say that for ages.
Yeah, I'm not embarrassed at all. I think it was Grant's mistake. But yeah, we picked up just what was really only a piece of the Australia Desk, and we ran that as the whole Australia Desk. So as Steve mentioned, we'll have a link to the full desk report from last week. Okay, a couple of quick shout-outs before we wrap this up. I just wanted to mention, last week we had an Across the Pond segment where Peter Johnson had some great sounds from the air show, the Air Day 2015. And I just want to point out that episode 44 of Aviation Extended has got kind of the full story. He's got even more sounds, great jet sounds in that episode, but also some really fascinating interviews from the show. Peter also passed along a YouTube video. Peter noted that he says we've talked a lot about the last season of flying from the Vulcan. And of course, they've covered that, and they've had some exclusive access over at the Extended Podcast to Bill Ramsey, one of the pilots. Well, there's this video titled Onboard XH-558 during Riot display that's pretty spectacular. So we'll put a link to that in the show notes. Thanks, Peter, for passing that along. Also, we heard from Micah. Micah sent us an article in the Portland Press Herald. This is Lou Lennart, pilot, Hollywood producer, and, quote, man who saved Tel Aviv, dies at 94. Lou Lennart was one of the men featured in Nancy Spielberg's documentary film Above and Beyond. You may recall that we had Harold Livingston, who was also in that film and also participated in those activities just after World War II. That was in Airplane Geeks episode 348. You might want to check that out. But sadly, we've lost Lou Lennart. He was one of the guys who was involved in that bombing raid on the Egyptian columns that Harold Livingston told us about. So I'll put a link to the article concerning that in the show notes. All right. I think that's about going to do it for this episode of the Airplane Geeks podcast. We want to thank you all for listening to episode 361. Find us at airplanegeeks.com. Show notes at airplanegeeks.com/361. Again, our guest was Rick Beach, Aviation Safety Chair of the Cirrus Owners and Pilots Association. Rick, again, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Glad to be here and share the message. Pleasure.
And the website folks can visit is cirruspilots.org.
Correcto.
And again, also thanks to Andre Borschberg, one of the two Solar Impulse 2 pilots. Follow them at solarimpulse.com. The other site mentioned is futureisclean.org. And Max Trescott, you really did spend a lot of time following along on their website. Can't wait for the next leg so we can all do that again.
I was really impressed by their website. You just had so much data. It was almost like being in the cockpit with him. And plus, you could see him there in the cockpit. So they did a phenomenal job of communicating to the world what was happening as that aircraft was in the air. And, of course, can't see all that. Now we have to wait for their next flight, which will be probably in April.
Max Trescott, tell our listeners where they can find you online, all the great stuff you're doing, all the books you've written, and all that.
Well, I'll start probably the usual places. Facebook, look for Max Trescott, T-R-E-S-C-O-T-T, or maxtrescott.com. Or my books are at g1000book.com.
And Rob Mark, where can folks find you online?
Well, they can find me on Facebook and Twitter under JetWine. They can find us at the blog, jetwine.com, at AirVenture, apparently. Amy Labota said I can come back and be her co-host next year on Attitude Adjustment, so I guess I'll be back there. And who knows where else I may appear.
Find us on Twitter, Facebook, Google+, Stitcher.com, and TuneIn Radio. Just look for Airplane Geeks. You can send us email to thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. Opening and closing music is by Brother Love. Find him at brotherloverocks.com. So join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Night, everybody.
Keep the blue side up.